Tonight on Arena, Pixar's Onward and the screen adaptation of Peter Carey's The True History of the Kelly Gang are up for review, and we hear about the opening night of Our New Girl at the Gate. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we'll start with our film reviews. Lots of interesting releases, in fact, for you hitting Irish cinemas this weekend. Onward, the latest emotional mindbender from Pixar. The Pieces I Am, a new documentary about the late Toni Morrison. Kristen Scott Thomas and Sharon Horgan team up for Military Wives. But we'll start with the big screen adaptation of Peter Carey's Booker Prize winning True History of the Kelly Gang. Joining me now are Roe McDermott and John Maguire. 20 years it is now from Peter Carey's novel was published. We are talking about historical events here, but they're not presented really in any kind of historically accurate way, are they?
No, and in fairness,
it's not about that.
Director Justin Kurzel, who made Snowtown, who's a very interesting director, he starts it with a title card saying absolutely nothing in this film is based on true events, which is slightly facetious because, of course, Ned Kelly exists, but it's more about subjectivity and the retelling of this infamous legend and how people venerate this person and how they think of him so differently. But also the direction has this kind of punk rock flavoured subjectivity where he's trying to evoke an atmosphere around these infamous characters. So it begins, it's kind of divided into three acts, and the first act is about Nick Kelly's childhood, and the opening shot sees a man in a beautiful red flowing dress on a horse galloping through this kind of scorched earth Australian outback. And from the outset you're thinking, this is interesting and odd. And it's about Nick Kelly growing up and seeing the harshness of the landscape around him and growing up with a mother who inflicts a lot of shame around what it means to be a man and enforcing this idea in her son. His father leaves the family at a young age, but he finds out that his father wore dresses, and this becomes an idea of shame. But then he brings it to his later criminal outings in order to kind of unnerve his enemies. So there's a queerness from the outset, but the first act is kind of very chronological and straightforward, and then slowly gets more a bit punk rock and subjective.
Right, well, let's have a listen to a little bit of the trailer, actually, that gives you a kind of a sense of some of the qualities you're talking about there, Ro.
My dear child, I write to you now, so you do not go to confuse fiction for fact and view your father in an unsavory light.
Do you like it out here, Ned? Living amongst dirt and disappointment?
We're rebels. Bandits. Warriors.
We're the Kelly Gang, yeah.
Are we gonna take the future and make it ours?
There is not a man born who could have the patience to suffer the injustice I have. So as you read this history, know that it will contain no single lie. May I burn in hell if I speak false.
And there we go, a little flavour there of the true history of the Kelly Gang. I've got my notes mixed up. Who is it that's playing the character of Ned Kelly in the midst of all of that?
The older Ned is George McKay, the actor
from 1917,
and a fine young British actor. And what Ro was saying about Kurzel's treatment of the material, and indeed Carey's treatment as well, is because it's so familiar. We know all the beats
story. There have been lots of film versions of this.
Mick Jagger, Yahoo Serious. Heath Ledger most recently. Let's hear. Here's a little extract from the Sydney Morning Sun's review of the 1910 re-release of the 1906 biopic of Ned Kelly, generally regarded as the first feature-length film made anywhere in the world. Perhaps in all the realms of fiction, no more romantic and sensational subject could be found for a biograph film, and it's still sensational.
And are we talking about it? I mean, it's mentioned there within the trailer itself, this idea of what's fact, what's fiction. Are we dealing with the mythology of the scenario?
That's often exactly what they're trying to do.
He's often presented as this kind of...
it out.
And he's presented as a Robin Hood character. Is that the version we get here, or is there something else going on?
This is the strangest thing about the film, is that we never see Ned Kelly rob a bank or steal a horse. It's not what the film really is about. What it's about is, what we should say really, is that it's who he was, not why he was. It's the kind of influences that he had on his life and the direction that his destiny took him. An inescapable destiny, the son of immigrant Irish sharecroppers, essentially, working in a shebeen, brewing their own hooch, father dead. taken under the wing of Russell Crowe's character, Harry Power, who again was a very famous bushranger and another hero in Australia, taught the ropes how to be a criminal, and then sent back, when he goes back home, sent out again in this inescapable destiny. And that's the struggle that McKay's character has. Though I preferred the kid, a young actor called Orlando Schwert.
A lot of praise for him. And quite a strong cast. I mean, obviously George McKay coming back off the success of 1917. Russell Crowe is in there. Essie Davis playing the mother. Nicholas Holt is in there as a kind of a Fitzpatrick. He has to be an Irish cop, I'm presuming, there.
The villain of the piece. And a very good performance from all of them. They're all as good as they've been for a long time.
What did you get from the cast in this one?
I think they're fantastic. I think Nicholas Holt and George McKay's character, they have this kind of homoerotic relationship where they both despise each other and have this begrudging respect, but also there are these power dynamics that are consistently played with, and I think there is a homoeroticism throughout the piece that is interesting, but it's never fully explored, which feels a little bit like queer baiting because they're taking kind of the aesthetic of queerness in some ways, but then never fully, you know, developing it. But I think Essie Davis is phenomenal in this. People know her from The Babadook because she plays Ned Kelly's mother, Ellen, and she's just this mercurial force of rage and sex and survival, and they have this kind of Oedipal dynamic where she views her son like she views all men, which is a means to an end, and that end is survival at all costs.
And Ro mentioned at the beginning, John, about the kind of the red dress and the image.
It's very strikingly photographed. Yeah. And the paintings of Sidney Nolan. Sidney Nolan. I think very much. He's there. Those are the iconic images.
He's seen in Irish Emma in 2013.
Irish people would have seen them up in Emma, yeah. And there's a lot of references and hints from the Nolan images that we see repeated, particularly a great shot where the horse riders travel across this blasted desert with the black trees with just one beam of light on them. And that's repeated throughout the film, and it's just gorgeous. But it's that sizzling visual style Kurzel has. That's what sets the film apart, even if it doesn't always benefit the actors, I didn't think. And the style tends to overwhelm the drama a little bit, particularly in the later stages when it turns into this kind of stroboscopic, almost like a punk rock music video. There's still some fantastic work.
Yeah, it sounds as if you both enjoyed it to different extents. What are you saying stars, first of all, John?
Four for me.
Four for you. So just it went that little bit off kilter towards the end. I think maybe not so for you, Ro.
I think four for me as well. I really appreciated the style of it, the atmosphere. I don't think it's perfect narratively, but I think the kind of sensibility and the sensuality of it is so intriguing.
The energy of it, yeah, is really overwhelming.
Very
at times,
kinetic and a little bit glam rock, and I'm all in for that.
So it's quite an exciting evening then in the cinema, and visually very warm.
And just something unexpected from such a familiar story, as John said.
All right, well, let us move onwards then. No pun intended, because that is our next film. Cheerily deals with mortality. And the death of a father is at the heart of this.
This is Onward, the new John. Pixar. Now, Pixar, we say the word Pixar, half the audience out there are going to prick up their ears and say, my kids love Pixar.
Or immediately start crying out of a Pavlovian response.
Or I was a kid who loved Pixar.
I was a kid once upon a time, and that's enough. So, and 2020 sees the 25th anniversary of the premiere of Toy Story, which was Pixar's first film, a game changer, a paradigm shifter. This digital animation, the revolution that they started. But since then, the success of Pixar really was their own demise, because they had a distribution deal with Disney. Disney saw what Pixar were up to, gathered together a huge amount of money, bought them out and folded them into their corporate structure. So we're at a point now where can Pixar continue as this cutting-edge studio making these amazing original Remember stories?
Well, this is the problem.
Or are they just another arm of a massive conglomerate feeding product to children?
Yeah, this is the problem. Is, you know, when you've had success, do you continue in that trajectory, or do you just say, right, that was successful because we were different, so now we have to be different again and again and again? What are they doing here, Ro?
I think that's interesting, because I think you can divide Pixar movies very firmly up into the ones that have a lot of soul and imagination and are really genuinely emotional, and ones that feel a bit more like product placement or like they've been focus grouped to death. And I feel like this is one of their far more safer offerings that we've seen in a while.
Very much so. Falls right in the middle of that kind of between the classics, the instant classics, and the product.
And a missing father at the heart of the story.
Which is very typical for a children's movie. So it's about two young creatures, I will say, who are Ian and Barley, who are brothers. But they live in this world that the narrator tells us long ago the world was full of wonder. And we're so named of what what the world was. It was this leafy fairy tale kingdom of elves and fairies and wizards. But then all magic was replaced by technological innovation. Is this a metaphor for real life?
I wonder.
So difficult. But these two brothers, Ian is younger. He's kind of gawky. He's a little bit insecure, but it's coming up
Ian
to his 16th
voiced by
birthday.
Tom Holland,
who people would know from Spider-Man. And his older brother, Barley, who is kind of very winningly voiced by Chris Pratt, who is kind of the clumsy person that people would know from Guardians of the Galaxy and Parks and Recreation. And he's kind of a heavy metal stoner type. And on Ian's 16th birthday, their mother presents them with a wizard staff that their father left for them. And the staff is imbued with a spell that they can cast to bring him back for one day. And so they do it, except it doesn't go completely right.
Yeah, so we won't say quite how it doesn't go right, because people will see that when they go to the movie. But let's hear a moment when the two brothers are chatting to each other, Tom Holland as Ian, Chris Pratt as Barley. And they're trying to work out how to use this magic wand and how difficult it is to use and how you have to, like most things, focus.
Here we go. Focus. Something wrong?
Sorry, it's just your stance is, here, chin up, elbows out, feet apart, back slightly arched. Okay, how's that feel?
Great.
Oh, one more thing.
Barley.
Okay.
Magnora, get you one.
Don't let the magic spook you.
Okay.
Elbows.
What?
Elbows up. No, it's too high. That's too high.
I'm trying to focus here.
Oh, yeah. Focus on the can.
Focus. Barley!
Ah, forget it!
It worked! The can is huge! And the band is huge! And you're... Oh, no.
Yes, they're all huge because you're small, far away. It's Father Ted sketch in the making there. Chris Pratt being shrunken by the wand, and Tom Holland then remaining as the size of himself. This absent father aspect of it, John. Pixar can do weighty picks in Up and in Inside Out. They
Inside
did all
Out
this
being
idea,
the
you know. They
not
really dealt with death.
They're not afraid of it, and they respect
and kids
the
have
audience.
To deal with that.
They respect their junior audience that they can comprehend these kind of things, process them, and deal with them over the course of 85 minutes. And that's what distinguishes them from a lot of the pap that's fed to children as entertainment. There is something really nuggety here in the middle of all of this, something that you have to tease out as you watch it. And what they do here very cleverly is that they transform the film from being a film about absent fathers into a film about brotherhood. And that happens very gradually and very organically in the midst of all this madcap comedy and people being shrunk and people turning into centaurs and all the other stuff.
And unicorns
that they do.
Are lovely. Unicorns are nasty animals. You don't want to run the place.
You know, you watch the screen and you're looking at the signs. All the signs of the various different shops have little puns in them, etc., etc. Yeah. So it's this rich visual tapestry. But in the middle of it, there's these really clever, really well teased out story elements that everybody responds to. And that's what distinguishes them from.
And is there
the
enough
of
that, or does it just kind of, it just doesn't have enough meat really to be amongst the Pixar big hit list?
I would say the film absolutely made me cry because I think the central relationship is so beautiful, and what they do with it towards
this
the end.
This is the brotherly relationship.
Yeah, and even their external characters, like there's a mother figure who's incredibly strong. She has a boyfriend who isn't demonized, which
is that
also
Julia Louis-Dreyfus? Is she playing the mother?
She is. Yeah. And you have people like Octavia Spencer who's playing this kind of griffin-esque monster who runs an old tavern that is now turned into a generic kind of almost McDonald's style franchise that she's very disappointed about, and it turns into an Indiana Jones road movie with lots of adventures.
It's 80 Spielberg is the model. 80 Spielberg, Weekend at Bernie's, Lord of the Rings, and big lumps of that kind of 80 Spielberg emotional stuff.
And I think that's the one thing that dragged it down a little bit for me, is that it's so rigorously loyal to the hero's journey kind of archetype in terms of the narrative and how it goes and how the relationship builds. So it feels predictable, but it also feels emotionally heartfelt. So it feels more conventional than, for example, a film like Inside Out, which was mind-blowing intriguing and interesting and challenging. And so it feels far more straightforward and conventional, but there is a lot of heart to it. But I think it's been slightly dampened down by just the traditional narrative.
Yeah, because I still haven't got over the fact that a fork, or a spork to be correct, spork. Made me cry all through Toy Story 4.
Bing Bong and Inside Out. Yeah. I can't even say the name.
Yeah, nor your own. So stars and an overall judgment here is kind of a mixed bag, Ro, from you, is it?
I think it's a 3.5. I think it's lovely. I think it's enjoyable. I think it's a very easy watch. I don't think it's as consistently outright funny as a lot of Pixar films. I don't think it's as challenging or as interesting, and doesn't grapple with, I think, bigger issues that Pixar have grappled with in the past in as interesting ways. So I think it's lovely, it's conventional, and I think it neatly sums up that Pixar, after 25 years, are still moving onwards, sometimes with a lot of imagination and vision, and sometimes with this one a little less so.
Yeah, but the onward does sound like they didn't get around to giving the movie a proper title.
Yes, we're short a title here, and there is a creeping sense of the generic right in the middle of the film, that there is this, we can kind of guess where they're going to go. Now, if you're 8 years old, maybe you won't guess, but
You'll have guessed it before we guess it.
Yeah,
the overeats.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah.
But starts from you, John.
I thought 3.5 as well is a perfectly fair score. And there is a brilliantly staged final act, but it doesn't quite make up for some of the stuff in the middle that just gets a bit sloppy.
All right. So 3.5 from both of you in the case of Pixar's Onward. We move on then to The Pieces I Am, feature-length documentary about the Nobel and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Toni Morrison, who died in August of last year. The film is made by Timothy Greenfield Sanders. HBO, he's done work with HBO, Greenfield Sanders role. Interesting work, yeah?
Yeah, he's done a lot of anthologies like the Latino List, the Outlist, and the Trans List. So he has this talent for weaving very human stories and narrative strands into this greater illuminating tapestry. And the same could be said for Toni Morrison, I believe, who is a writer whose artistic and cultural and historical legacy could only be elevated by her own insights. And we do indeed get that here, because she is a featured interviewee. And I think so much of the joy of this film is seeing Toni Morrison, who is such a joyful, sparky, witty, just engaging presence. And she's able to tell stories about her life and then situate them within both the cultural context and within the context of her own career. So, for example, she'll tell stories about her childhood, about seeing a young black girl wishing that she had blue eyes. And she'll weave it into this beautiful narrative, not only of childhood memories and her awareness of race, but also kind of a legacy of racism and colorism, and then it will turn into how she wrote The Bluest Eye. And so she's just such a beautiful storyteller about her own life, and then to put it in the hands of an accomplished director is just a joy.
Yeah, now obviously there's the public figure here, and there's the author, and there's the former editor at Random House who became the author that we're talking about here. Do we learn much about the private Toni Morrison, the woman behind all of
that? I learned a lot about Toni Morrison because, and I know this is a terrible admission to make on an art show, I had never read one of her books before this. I was aware of her work as an educator and as an advocate, as an editor, like you say, with Random House, and that she was a woman who combined this glorious career, Pulitzer Prizes, Nobel Prize winning author, with raising two children on her own, and that she had this life. But I think we hear her story through her own eloquent and moving words. And she has such a powerful command, a mastery of language, written and spoken. I'd be stunned if she ever said something that wasn't totally magnificent. Yeah. She is an extraordinary presence.
Yeah,
this beautiful woman. She has absolute and total control of everything that she's saying, and an ability to nail it every time she opens her mouth.
Yeah,
I could listen to her all day.
There was a great clip of it's an archival clip, because there's obviously archival stuff and interviews within this. Great clip of her, and there's a guy interviewing her. A white man interviewing her, asking, "Well, you know, what about this label of black writer?" He said, "Are you tired of it?" She said, "No, I revel in it." And she follows that up with this, "But I am tired of being asked the question."
That's the thing. And you see how spiky she is, but in completely necessary and justified ways, in that she's able to handle these constant microaggressions and this constant form of really patronising racism from white journalists who think that they're doing the Lord's work by bringing up racism in these really patronising ways. But she also brings so much joy to her storytelling. I think that's important, because we're so used to seeing black narratives and they're just defined by trauma and pain. So she'll talk about racism within the literary industry. She'll talk about the barriers she faced in publishing. She'll talk about being a single mother. But then she'll also have her friends like Oprah pops in, and Angela Davis and Fran Lebowitz. And they'll say, you know those people who they invite you to a party and they say, bring no gifts? Toni Morrison never says that. Always bring gifts. And there's this sense of fun and charisma.
And those kind of, they're almost like conversations rather than interviews then. Because I have a clip of Angela Davis, and they're speaking about about beloved here. So it's not just anecdotal chat between two friends. There's fairly hefty analysis going on as well, is there?
Yeah, I think the interviewers who remain on scene, they obviously ask really great questions, and they get into the depth and the heart of these issues. So
they're
talk
kind
about
of nudging the two into conversation in these clips.
Absolutely, but I think also because the interviewees love Toni Morrison so much, but they also love her work so much. So we hear a great story from Oprah about how Oprah read Toni Morrison's work and then literally chased her down and was like, I want to talk about your books on air. Please let me have this book for the Oprah's book club. And you see, even when Toni Morrison wasn't recognised on the world stage yet, people just recognised the value of her work. And so it means when they're speaking about it, they can bring together all these narrative strands.
Well, let's listen to a clip then that features, you mentioned Angela Davis, the writer, in the midst of that with Toni Morrison. And in this case, they're talking about Morrison's novel, Beloved.
I don't mean that there were no narratives that slave women told and there was no information about them. I mean, it wasn't the narrative in literature. My effort in saying Beloved to do that, to talk about a woman who had to make some choices about slavery, about motherhood, about love, about parenting, that had nothing to do with being a victim. A real woman, a historical figure, as a matter of fact, who was anything but a victim. This is a woman who said, these children are mine. No. I can do with them what I want.
When Toni Morrison published Beloved, it was an extraordinary turning point in the history of this country, and I would say the history of the world, because she urged us to imagine people who were slaves as human beings, individuals with subjectivity, who also loved, who also had imaginations, even as they were subjected to the most horrendous modes of repression. We can never think about slavery in the same way.
There we go, Angela Davis and Toni Morrison in the new documentary about Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am. John was very
kindly and forthright
honestly. And honestly admitting to not having read any Toni Morrison. Does that matter? You have read. Does that matter, Ro?
I don't think so, honestly, because I think so many people are familiar with her legacy. Yeah. And I think what it did for me was made me want to go read everything that I hadn't read already. Mm. And even they show a clip from the film adaptation of Beloved, which I haven't seen.
Which I have seen.
They dance around the fact that it was a bit of a flop, to be honest.
A total bomb is what it means, yes.
But I think it just inspires you, because I think when you hear other people talking about her work, particularly, you understand the resonance that it has with people in the lasting resonance. I will also say the production of this is so beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautifully made.
They incorporate a lot of black art and a lot of gospel music and soul music and jazz. And so it feels playful and emotional and almost situates Toni Morrison's work, without saying it explicitly, within a context of black art and black literature. Yeah,
I got out of the film mostly was Morrison's, like you were saying earlier about being asked these awful questions by these ignorant white journalists, that everything she said and does is try to mirror, just literally trying to hold a mirror up to whatever prejudices
and
you're bringing
will
to the work.
Will it send you off to get some
I
of the books
so.
And read
There's
them,
a big
John.
Stack now, Sean, but I think we can get
start,
to it.
Where would you say start, Ro? Beloved?
Beloved is amazing. I think The Bluest Eye.
I like the sound of The Bluest Eye from the documentary.
Right. And then Sula is also stunning. Okay, so I think there's so much to dip into.
Stars from you on this one, first of all, John?
Oh, 4 stars. This is quite an excellent documentary. Really well made. And as an introduction to it's extraordinary.
Ro?
I think 4 as well. I think it's really lovely, and I think the interviewees are just so enthusiastic and effusive that it makes you leave the cinema with that sense of enthusiasm for her work.
You played the clip there, Sean, and we are urging people to go and see the movie, but you could go and hear the movie as well.
Clips work brilliantly for radio, which isn't always the case with films, obviously different medium. Let's move on then to Military Wives.
Oh, do we have to do that?
Yes, we do.
Oh, no.
Triumph over adversity story. Oh, Kristen Scott Thomas and Sharon Horgan. Now, there's two.
No,
good
Sharon Horgan and Kristen Scott Thomas.
Leading
no problem
actors
with that.
For starters,
the two of them were excellent in Aisling Bay's sitcom there last year. And they're both fine actors, and I have no problem with that. But this is a very patchy comedy drama that tells about how a group of ordinary women gained an unlikely fame in 2011 when their British Army base choir was chosen to sing at the Remembrance Day ceremony at the Albert Hall. Now, I didn't get to the real story, but Peter Cataneo has, who's the guy who did the Full Monty all those years ago and has been searching for another hit ever since. He's created the blueprint.
It's very similar. It's Calendar Girls. It's
you can
the
list
Full Monty.
The
it's,
litany.
It's that
there
type
is
of
a litany,
film.
Exactly. And it's the blueprint for that kind of inspirational British comedy drama whose crowd-pleasing formula has been very carefully
calculated. Would I be crazy to think now that Kristen Scott Thomas might be terribly uptight and
exactly.
posh
yeah,
and all the
and
rest
posh,
and the Sharon Horgan's character might be saying, come on, let's do it for the crack.
That's almost it, Sean. You could wrap it up there because that's the whole movie. Kirsten Scott is the Brigadier General's wife, Kate. She's the mother of a son who was killed in the conflict, which is something that they don't really explore to the extent that they could.
Yeah.
But she's given the job of keeping up morale when the husbands and wives are off in the war in Afghanistan. And it's a duty she shares with Lisa, Sharon Horgan's character, who's the mother of a teenage daughter who has alighted on this idea of forming a choir for a laugh. But of course, Kirsten Scott Thomas's character can't do anything for a laugh. The two clash and then they make up and then they laugh and then they cry, then they bond, then they fall out, and we inch closer and closer to the Albert Hall and a big finale.
Right, well, let's listen
when
to...
When it works, it hums along, no problem, but when it doesn't...
Okay, well, let's have a listen here to... this is a scene where they're rehearsing and in comes... a boss in uniform with a big message.
How long are you waiting? Time after time. Time after time.
I need to speak to you all.
Oh, Jesus. Is it about the bloke doll we sent out to Bastion?
She's joking.
Brigadier Groves heard you rehearsing when he was here a few weeks ago, and he's told the top brass. And you've been invited to sing at the Festival of Remembrance.
The Festival of Remembrance on TV? The big one?
That one.
At the Royal Albert Hall?
I can't wait to tell my mum. Do you reckon we're allowed to be able to see it out in Afghan?
Hope not.
Listen, you don't need to worry. We are going to be match fit after that market gig.
Yeah, well, it's all right for you, Mars. You haven't got to do a solo.
Well, just see the market as, like, a dress rehearsal.
Yeah. And I'll be by your side. Shoulder buddies.
There you go. Among the voices you heard there, Jason Fleming is the guy coming in with the message. Jess, played by Gabby French. And you also heard Kristen Scott Thomas and Sharon Horgan in the midst of that. God, you've been very cynical about it all. Did you get a big lump in your throat
more than once? No, there was no
lumps.
You did.
Lump
go free. On. But I'll tell you, they're very watchable actors. Some of the singing is very lovely. But the jokes are few and far between. And the emotional landscape is so... clearly signposted, well beyond the point of manipulation, and that completely undermines what all the good work that they're doing. It's a bit of a formula.
All right. What are you saying, stars, John?
Three, I would say. Three.
Three.
Three for Sharon, because I like Sharon Horgan.
All of them for Sharon Horgan,
aren't they? Pretty much, yeah.
Let's not be at all nationalist about this. That's Military Wives, the final movie that John
if
was
speaking
about.
If you think Onward is struggling for a title, Military Wives is struggling for a title.
That's what they were called. That's what the choirs were called.
I think people would
probably get that title, fairly quickly. Onward, then, the Pixar that we spoke about, True History of the Kelly Gang, and Toni Morrison, the documentary, The Pieces I Am. That's what John McGuire and Roe McDermott were speaking to us about this evening. But just before we wrap up in the film world, no Bond coming our way. And it's for people to be safe in the cinemas. Now,
that's the official excuse as given by...
What do you think is actually going on here,
I think
John?
E.ON, who the people who control Bond. Bond, remember, is a multi-billion dollar international global phenomenon in cinema. The films are very keenly anticipated and they sell everywhere from Ballinasloe to Bangalore. Everybody goes to a Bond movie. And
Ballinasloe to Bangalore. I wish I'd thought of that.
This is a massive thing. Bond is huge. And for them to make a decision to pull it back by 6 months, ostensibly because of the coronavirus, ostensibly because it will damage their box office returns in China, where the cinemas are closed and will be closed for the foreseeable. And in, you know, European countries where they're already limiting mass gatherings and things like that. That's all fine. I think.
Well, let me just ask you before, I know you have a conspiracy theory here.
We won't say a conspiracy, it's a theory.
But, you know, we all know that when you're looking for a preview, a screening of a movie, when the previews are hard to find, it usually means this is an absolute turkey and they don't want you to see the preview. Do you think there is something wrong with the film
and they're kind of hoping that by delaying, the money is the big thing.
Right.
I mean, the money is inescapable because it's so massive. Spectre, the last Bond film, did $1.3 billion just in box office returns.
Okay.
I mean, that's a huge number. So nobody's going to mess with that.
What were you going to say there, Ro?
Just the coronavirus, it is estimated to knock $5 billion off the global box office, mainly because cinemas in China and Korea have been shut down.
Exactly.
Which, of course, they don't want to share in that. But in terms of reshoots and in terms of maybe it's not working,
we have to go back and rework it and let's take the 6 months and do that. That's speculation. Yeah. But I don't know. Now, my speculation is that the Bond film might well be about the release of a global virus, some kind of...
Any evidence on this, John? Or
well,
the, pure
my only evidence would be that looking through before I came in, I was looking through the online, the listing of the cast members. Now, these are, you know, you've got your Daniel Craigs and your everybody else that's in the film. But you scroll down and you see a long list of actors who are credited as Dr. Scientist, Dr. Scientist, Dr. Scientist. And, you know, you might think to yourself, well, there's a lot of doctors in this movie.
There might be a lot of scientists in this movie.
And it wouldn't be an unprecedented move to delay the release of a film because it feels too topical.
Exactly.
So, for example, you know, films being taken off release schedules because of mass shootings that have happened.
Like The Hunt, which opens in a couple of weeks now. Another 6 or 7 months.
Gone Baby Gone was released, or was the release was delayed for several months because of the Maddie McCann scandal.
And that disappearance happened. So I think there's something
in the film, in the plot of the film, of which we know nothing about, and that's good. And it's good that we don't know anything about it. So I'm only guessing. It's only speculation.
All right. Well,
I think there might be something in a germ lab somewhere in China, even.
We'll find out, but we won't find out for seven months.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's John McGuire there and Ro McDermott with their theories around the possibilities of why the Bond movie is delayed. Deep Blue from Mango and Mathman there, featuring the voice of Lisa Hannigan. And that is one of the 10 songs nominated for the RTE Choice Music Prize Irish Song of the Year 2019. And we spoke about the albums last night, and indeed we heard from one of the other nominated songs, Lyra with Falling. But we will hear the results of that. The actual event is happening right now in Vicar Street in Dublin, so we'll be hearing the winners over the next couple of hours, I would guess. Last night at Dublin's Gate Theatre, the Irish premiere of Our New Girl by Nancy Harris took place, with Catherine Walker playing the role of Hazel, a successful lawyer who has decided to put her career to one side in order to run an olive oil business from home and look after her 8-year-old son. When a nanny arrives to help her out, a psychological drama unfolds. Helen Meaney was at the Gate Theatre last night. She's with me in studio this evening. This is the third Nancy Harris play to be programmed at the Gate since Selina Cartmell took over as director. Is that significant? Well, it is significant. Three plays in that period of time. 2 years, essentially. 3 years.
Yes, it was. It was The Red Shoes, directed by Selina Cartmell herself. Lovely show.
Christmas show in 2018. That Christmas, before last.
And then just last October at Dublin Theatre Festival, The Druid and Gate co-production of The Beacon. Mm. And so this is the third. And so I think it's a signal of Selina Cartmell's support of contemporary women writers.
Yeah, and
it's a big change.
This had been given a premiere in London previously.
That's right, at the Bush Theatre in 2012. So this is the Irish premiere.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess that's something that had happened with lots of Conor McPherson plays being done in the Bush and then coming here.
Yeah.
Nancy Harris has had quite a successful career
so far in London.
But her plays have not been seen here as much as
well.
You would
so
hope.
There was No Romance at the Abbey in 2011. Mm. And then the Beacon I suppose, right. was the next big production. The Red Shoes was an adaptation of the film. So The Beacon is an original piece, and this play is an original piece.
And we're set in a very fashionable North London.
We are with a quite a well-heeled couple.
This is the Catherine Walker's character
called Hazel. Yes, who is was a high flying lawyer, high achiever, who has given up her professional life to stay at home and be a full time parent to her son Daniel. And
is the parenting the first reason for the giving up?
I think what happens is that we're not sure about that at the beginning, and that the reasons start to emerge.
Right.
And so she is at home with the 8-year-old. She's struggling with that, and the play opens with the arrival of a stranger on her doorstep, who is an au pair, a nanny, and a young woman from Sligo called Annie, and who is sent completely out of the blue, as far as Hazel is concerned, to join the household.
But isn't there a very kind of opening prologue scene of a young boy on stage?
There is. So the scene is set for some sort of family disturbance. Mm. There's an element of threat. There's a sense of foreboding set up.
Self-harming might be involved.
Possibly self-harming. And we know that this mother is struggling, right, with the child. What we don't know, and what is hinted at, but is to what degree her fears are justified.
Right.
She's become slightly paranoid and slightly afraid of the child. And I think all the adults start circling around the child and suggesting that he may be very disturbed.
That's part of the plot of the play.
There is a sense of dread built up,
right,
in this very, very well. But the arrival of the stranger, of course, is the classic.
Well, the stranger, you know. the husband is away. Richard, played by Aidan McArdle, who people, if they were watching the trial of Christine Keeler, he played Roger Hollis of MI5 in that, and you'd know him anyway. He's lots of very well thought of Irish actor.
Yeah.
He's absent in the beginning when the stranger comes in, but he's set up for the stranger, played by Lougheed McGowan, who plays this nanny, Annie,
who has just arrived from Sligo. Mm. And so she arrives expecting, she thinks that she is expected, but she hasn't been. And
right.
So, in other words, the husband has taken a kind of an executive decision to employ this woman.
Possibly so think twice about that one.
I think everybody finds themselves in an extraordinarily kind of tense situation.
Yeah. And it's a very different type of energy. You were talking about Catherine Walker's character, is that there's a sense of foreboding. You get the sense that that things are out of control, that she's finding it hard to hold on to things. Whereas Annie, as played by Lougheed McGowan, this is calmness personified.
She's extremely cool and calm, and she then becomes an intermediary between the husband who returns and she's being asked to kind of intervene or to give her opinion or to adjudicate between the couple, and the tensions are ramping up. So she's an observer, she's infiltrated herself, and all sorts of things start to...
So we have husband, wife and nanny, and then the young son.
And the son.
That's it.
So we're in a domestic interior for the entire piece. So it becomes quite claustrophobic. So really we're in their kitchen, which is this very stylized, stylish, kind of architect-designed space that's sleek and sophisticated. So there's plenty of money, but it's a very miserable... I think as it goes on, we realise how unhappy this family is.
And a fair amount of olive oil about the place.
There's a lot of olive oil, which is quite a fun satirical thing about Hazel. You know, she's at home. She's not happy being at home as a full-time parent. So she thinks she might develop a sideline,
right,
importing olive oil. And really, that's not going to go anywhere.
But that's the one little bit of fun, I think, that you have possibly here. Because the tension that you were speaking about in terms of the dynamics between the unexpected nanny and the mother at home, the difficulties with the son, is he disturbed or is he not disturbed, what's going on there? So there's a lot of tension there. That's also built by the production and the production design.
Yeah, that's right. So Annabelle Cumman is the director, and she's just very assured. She knows that she manages the tone extremely well. And then there's a lot of the lighting by Aidan Cosgrove and the sound design and composition by Philip Stewart. They just ramp up a sense of suspense. I must say, I got to the interval and I realised I've been sitting kind of clenched.
I'm getting tense.
clenched in my seat. I realised I hadn't moved for about 40 minutes because you'd think things are going to happen. It doesn't turn necessarily, there are twists to the plot, but there's, so for example, there's a lot of use of a kitchen knife, a very sharp, large kitchen knife. And you just don't know. It's a bit like the Chekhov, you know, when you introduce a gun in the first act, is it going to be used?
Yeah,
you don't
knife.
Know about that knife. You just don't know. And there's broken glass on the floor. And there is an incident with a broken glass being thrown. But actually the way it turns is actually, it goes in a different direction.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much you'd want to tell me, but the nanny gives quite a bit of her own backstory. And
does this
add into the tension?
Very much so. She has come from a farm in Sligo, and we find out that her mother committed suicide when she was a child and abandoned, just left her six children, and you know, jumped into the river. It's an awful story, an awful experience for Annie, and also then her father was violent. So the husband Richard is a plastic surgeon who goes around the globe as a sort of a savior of people. So he's very drawn. He sympathizes deeply with Annie. But she's not. What's interesting about Annie and the brilliant performance, I thought, is
from Lóithín Magán.
Yeah, is that she's not a victim. She's had these terrible experiences, but she doesn't present herself as a victim.
And the other performances,
I thought overall very, very good, and the writing is extremely sharp.
Yeah, let me ask you about the writing, because you know this idea of building tension. I mean, there are a million and one ways to raise tension in writing, but you know, I'm wondering to what extent does Nancy Harris use, you know, floods of language to do that, or is it very spare and sparse language with pauses and gaps?
Crackling dialogue. So she's a great, great observer of relationships, particularly close family relationships, and also the tensions. She's very, very good on secrets and lies. So there's blazing rows between Hazel and Richard, and that are observed by Annie. And then occasionally they get a long monologue where you get to understand a little bit more about them.
Their side of the row.
And Hazel is a complicated character in that she's got layers. So that we find out more about what she was like as a lawyer, and you realise she was absolutely brilliant. And she is just not happy with her life, and she's not happy being a mother. So the play is really good on those tensions between being your parental commitments and being professionally fulfilled, and then the way that generates kind of gender wars between the couple and general misery. It's extremely well observed.
Yeah, even though you just said general misery and you've told us that you were clenched and tense after 40 minutes, I think you're going to recommend this and recommend it quite highly, aren't you?
I am recommending it because it feels very true. The rows that they have feel absolutely, they're honest and they're tough, but it's very believable. There are certain things in the plot that are less believable, but as written, I thought Hazel and Richard. Richard is possibly a bit of a caricature, but when he's sympathetic, he's very sympathetic. So it's not black and white. I love the way Nancy Harris, she just takes a very layered view of the reality of people being both selfish and unselfish.
Yeah, so everybody's right and everybody's wrong all at the same time.
We're just very human, and it gives you loads and loads to think about afterwards.
Loads to think about. A recommendation from you, Helen Meaney. That's Helen Meaney speaking to us about Our New Girl, the Nancy Harris play that's running at the Gate Theatre. It's quite a short run, really. It's only there until March the 21st, so you probably need to get a move on if you want to get to see that. And you can find out full details on gatetheatre.ie. Arlene Hunt is a regular contributor to this programme, but she was in with us recently to talk about her latest novel, No Escape. And while she was doing that, she took the opportunity to tell us about a 1987 slice of feel-good cinema, which holds a particularly special place in her heart.
My name is Arlene Hunt and I adore the film Moonstruck, directed by Norman Jewison.
The moon is a little like love.
Will you marry me?
I will marry you. I will be your wife.
You love him, Loretta?
No.
Good. When you love him, they drive you crazy.
This is a romantic comedy that was released in December 1987, and it starred Cher, Nicolas Cage, Olympia Dukakis, Vincent Gardenia, Julia Bovasso, Danny Aiello, John Mahoney from Frasier, most people would know him from, Louis Gus, and Fyodor Chaplin Jr. The movie was a commercial and critical success and went on to be nominated for 6 Oscars and won the Best Original Screenplay for John Patrick Shandley and Best Actress for Cher and Best Supporting Actress for Olympia Dukakis. So for me, Moonstruck is the absolute perfect movie. It's the perfect Christmas movie. My daughter and I watch it every single year without fail. We watch it on Christmas Eve every single year because it's just perfect. It's just perfect for the festive season. It's perfect for the holidays. It makes me feel like Christmas is just about to begin every time it comes on. The cast is perfect. The backdrop, New York, is perfect. The supporting cast, the plot is perfect. I mean, it's set over 3 days where Loretta Castorini, and she's a widow and she accepts a wedding invitation from her boyfriend, Johnny. He is leaving to go to Palermo to tell his mother about this wedding he's about to have. He has to be prompted to get down on one knee to actually ask for marriage. He hasn't got an engagement ring with him, so he has to pop his pinky ring on her finger. But even so, Loretta, who's played by Cher, agrees she's going to marry this man, and she goes home to tell her father. The only caveat he says to her is he wants her to go talk to his brother, Ronnie, who they have been estranged. And he wants her to go talk to Ronnie and ask Ronnie to come to the wedding and bury the bad blood between the brothers. And so Loretta agrees to do this. She goes home to tell her parents that she's going to get married. And her father, Cosmo, is immediately against it. Why? Because she was married before. And so he says to her, why, Loretta, you've been married before. It doesn't work. So she tells her mother, Rose, who's played amazingly by Olympia Dukakis, that she's going to get married. And the only thing Rose wants to know is, does she love him?
Do you love him, Loretta?
No.
Good. When you love him, they drive you crazy.
And so the next following day, Loretta goes to the bakery to meet with Ronnie, who's played by Nicolas Cage. And Ronnie is just so incensed when he finds out that she's getting married to his brother, Johnny, because according to Ronnie, Johnny is the reason that Ronnie has a prosthetic hand and lost his fiance. He blames all of his bad luck on his brother, and that's the bad blood between them. And Loretta thinks this is ridiculous, and she goes upstairs to have an argument with him in his apartment. She cooks a steak for him, rare, to feed his blood, and in the process of the argument tells him that he's just a wolf and that the wolf chewed off his own hand to get away from the trap, and that you could cut the sexual tension in the scene with a butter knife. Ronnie, in his rage, overturns a table, swoops Loretta up in his arms and carries him to his bedroom, and she quite willingly goes, and thus begins the huge romance of Moonstruck.
Where are you taking me?
To the bed.
Oh God. Okay, I don't care. Take me to the bed.
Isn't it romantic?
From here on in, it's just a waiting game for Johnny to come back and profess his love. But of course, that doesn't really happen. It doesn't happen the way you think it's going to happen. Johnny comes back. He's poor aged mother in Sicily, suddenly on hearing the fact that her son is going to get married, sits up in bed and cooks a huge meal for people. It's a miracle, he says, when he comes back home, which is nonsense. And so it just becomes this amazing love story. It becomes this amazing romance between Loretta and between Ronnie. And it's all based around the opera La Boheme. It's all based around Puccini's music. And it's just one of the absolute best films to watch. And I think anyone that watches it just comes away with a really warm and glowy feeling from just watching this incredible movie.
You
ruined my life.
That's impossible. You ruined my life.
Look, it's Cosmo's moon.
Why do men chase women?
Nerves. I don't want to talk about it.
Thank you.
Ah, yes, opera fans may recognise that, I am sure, as Quando Main Vo, the wonderful soprano aria, a waltz in Act Two of Puccini's opera La Boheme. But the version that you heard there was, it's also referred to as Musetta's Waltz, even by opera fans. But it is definitely referred to as Musetta's Waltz when it's played by the American jazz pianist and arranger Dick Hyman as on the movie soundtrack to Moonstruck. And before all of that, you heard Arlene Hunt telling you just why she loves Moonstruck. I have to say, I agree with most of what she said on that particular score. But that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Albums for you tomorrow night. They've gone out of my head. We have Anna Calvi is there, is one of the albums certainly that we'll be looking at. And we're talking about a new novel called My Name is Bina. That and more for you tomorrow night here in Arena. But that's it for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. The broadcast coordinator was Janice Murphy. Kieran Cullen was on sound. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.